Thank you, Brother Jim. Sister Linda. Well, as you can see from the program, Brother Harry has for us his discourse entitled The Cries of the Reapers. The Cries of the Reapers. Brother Harry.
Are you still out there? Okay. Good morning, brethren. This is actually a very exciting topic, the cries of the reapers. It has to do with some of the mechanics of some tremendously powerful forces that God brought to bear to accomplish his will. Sister Karen had asked, we're going to be talking about, you see, a gold, 1874 gold dollar there, 1878 silver dollar, and all of this has to do with the cries of the reapers, the dynamics we want to talk about. Now, Sister Karen, at the beginning, she said, before we came, she says, you're not doing this after lunch, are you? I said, why is that? She said, well, I used to always fall asleep in economics right after lunch. So hopefully that won't be the case. Because it's not just going to be, you know, things you may learn in a dry classroom, but this is actually God's plan being worked out on the world stage, the entire world, to bring about the destruction of that church-state system. Okay. Where does this come from? It's really from James 5, verses 1 through 9. These are a few excerpts from that. Go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. You have heaped treasure together for the last days. Note that, the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. And the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton. The earth, their established society, religious society. But behold, now the judge standeth before the door. Does that give you chill bumps? It does me. So this is a prophecy of the last days. It has to do, and in the last days, beginning 1874, we know the time of trouble is coming. It's building towards that. The whole point is we're going to destroy the church-state system, that those who have had really dominion over the Lord's people. He's going to bring them out of there. He's also going to liberate the Jews, get them back into Palestine. Really, the only ones who win, you might say, who won World War One? Well, really nobody militarily, but who are the ones who made out the best? Well, the Jews did in Palestine. End of Gentile times? Well, there are only Jews and Gentiles. It must be the beginning of Jewish times. So this is just thrilling. This chapter, The Cries of the Reapers, fits in perfectly with this because it's really about the forces, many forces that are going to be bringing upon Armageddon, these underlying things that are going to urge it on. It's going to be a constant irritation to society, forcing them to make this change. We know that the fourth volume is really a discussion of the seven last plagues. In the forewords, he bases it on those, on Revelation 16. And this upheaval of society cannot take place unless it's done from its very foundation. And that's what we're going to see, getting to the very foundation of society. Well, one scripture I really appreciate, Brother Russell brings out, as he's in the fourth volume, wait ye, this Zephaniah 3:8, wait, therefore wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. So we're going to see this gathering. How is this gathering done? Well, it's done economically. The nations of Europe, they had colonies all over the planet. In fact, we'll show you a map of the world near the end, and little shadings in it is where they had colonies. And you'll see virtually everything is shaded except Greenland and Antarctica. But it's just amazing. But God would use this linkage, economically linkage, to bring all the nations together so he could shake the very stability and foundation of society. Now, when we go through this, we want to keep in mind some questions as we go through. So what was the most stable element of society? If we're going to shake the foundation, foundation should be the most stable. Well, what was it? And whoever this is, what happened to them? And how did it actually happen? Were they alone, or did this happen to others? Did the politicians and the kings, actually, you know, the ones who they thought, okay, they're ruling by divine right, they know what's going on, did their politicians and kings, especially when we look at Christendom, the divine right of kings, did they even know what was happening? Did they demonstrate any godlike wisdom, or did they demonstrate complete incompetence, ignorance? And the fact that they should all be fired. Send those guys to the unemployment line. Could they fix it once they found out what was going on? Now, who did this? Who propagated this? How did the monetary system work at that time? Because we know this has to do with money. What was the ultimate result of this? How did this affect Christendom? And also, is there an upside to this? Is there some upside we can look at? And we're also, I didn't put this last one, but is there actually some justice in it? And I think we'll find, yes, actually there is, if you look a little deeper, farther back in history. Well, the farmer, the most stable element, this is no surprise to anybody, was the farmers. The farmers, traditionally, they create value out of the land and their labor. They grow the crops, they produce the food. If you got nothing else, you know, if you have a lean-to over your head and you got some food to eat, some clothing to throw on, you're going to be able to live. So this whole idea of producing food, very, very important, very, very important. This is really the foundation of society, that producing this food. And because of this, because the farmers are right there producing the food, they were essentially independent of a lot of the changes in society, the political events. They said, well, we don't worry about it. You know, we're growing our crops. We're producing our wealth every year. Our crops are going to be bought by somebody. We can use that for the necessities that we need. And for centuries and centuries, they could be left down on the farm by themselves for the most part. They'd be fine. They wouldn't even know what's happening in the cities or at the government. They weren't necessarily rich, but they were stable. It was a hard life, but at least there was life. Brother Don is nodding his head. His dad's a farmer. His brother's a farmer. Well, we find that with the time of the end, we find that changes are coming upon them. No longer are countries all separated with very limited transportation and trade. But actually, with the time of the end, we have wars taking place, a draft putting people from all walks of society into the armies. What do? Well, they don't just hand them a gun and march them out into the field. They have to give them education. They have to give them training. They're going to be subject to some of the features of the Industrial Revolution, because really the greatest advances in mankind in technology have been for war. So whatever the latest technologies are, that's used in the wars, and these folks are going to be learning about it. New ideas, new opportunities. So how are you going to keep them down on the farm unless they've been drafted in the army for a while? They come home, their eyes are open. Brother Harry Grable here can tell you, after he was in the Navy, he saw the world, changed his outlook, and then he saw the truth and saw the reasons for these things. Well, with the time and the end, the to and fro, very important. Trains, ships, barges. Not just sailing ships, but steamships, things that are reliable and can go on trade routes where sailing ships could not go. Trains that could take crops from the farm into the city, onto the barges, down the Mississippi, world trade, etc. So you have international trade now being practical in cotton and wheat and several other crops. And of course, if you have international trade, you're going to have international competition. Now all of a sudden, you're competing with the folks in other countries, China, Argentina, other countries, things that at that time were really fourth world countries, you might say. But what is happening is the nations are being linked. The economies of the world are now linking up with each other. They're no longer independent. Now, it used to be in China. China didn't worry about the rest of the world, but once China was opened up, Japan was opened up, now they're economically and politically linked with the rest of the entire planet. So, if we take a look at the United States versus Europe, in the United States, typically you had larger farms that were family-owned. In Europe, you had smaller farms, but they were owned by large land dwellers. So aristocracy that would own the land, they'd rent it out to the farmers, because after all, the aristocracy didn't want to get that dirt under their fingernails, right? But they wanted the money, so they'd rent it out to folks who didn't own land. They would work the farms, sell the crops, and they'd pay the rent through the crops that they sold. So the crops, the sale of the crops was their livelihood. They're dependent upon that. Well, if we look at 1873, prices are good, sales are good, life is good, everything's fine. Technology is helping them to keep up with the world demand. Everything's great. Well, in 1874, that's an important date, things start changing. Prices begin to fall. The farm prices begin to fall, especially in the international prices. Cotton, wheat, the big ones. In fact, when you take a look at the international trade for the United States, that was 80% of our exports was agricultural products, cotton, wheat, etc. A lot of the cotton, that went off to Great Britain for their textile industry. The industry in this country was starting to grow, but our agricultural products, that was the raw materials for the rest of the world and the food for the world. So we can see the prices began to fall, and later they began to plummet. And if you take a look at these numbers, this is a scary thing. Now, if you were in business and you had a product you were selling and you saw the prices do this, in the years from 1873 to 1896, you have a price drop of 53%. Half of the price just falls right out. Over half of the revenue you had before is now gone. Look at it in England. England, 1873 to 1894, a fall of 61%. If you're in business and you saw that happen, you're still producing the goods, but now you're getting less than half what you got before. This would be devastating. Devastating to you. So what's the cause? Well, they're saying, all right, well, let's figure this out, you know, because we got a lot of smart folks. And perhaps it's overproduction. Is that the problem? Well, this is right out of the third volume. There's a fellow named Robert Lindblom from the Chicago Board of Trade. He was looking at the history of this. And a lot of folks were saying, well, it's just overproduction. You know, the farmers are so efficient, they're producing so much more, and because of supply and demand, the prices are falling. And so Robert said, I wonder if that's really true. And I like his attitude. He didn't just take what everybody else is telling me. He says, I'm going to check it out for myself. So he did. And he found that in 1883, 1.56 billion bushels were being produced. And in 1893, notice it's 1.479. It's down. It's gone down by 5%. You figure if what you're selling, if it's now scarcer, supply and demand would raise the price. But they're actually producing less. It's not overproduction, it's underproduction. And the price is still plummeting. So, you say, well, what is causing this? Here are some more price examples. Cotton in 1878 through 1894. Cotton went from 1878. I think I've got this backwards. But cotton went from 11 cents to 7 cents from 1878 to 1894. That's just to see if you're awake. wheat per bushel went from $1.20 down to 61 cents. You can see these drops. That's just precipitous. It's just dropping like the rain is falling. So there's some examples. So what is really the cause of this? Well, Brother Russell wrote the fourth volume in 1897. And from 1873 to 1896, there was something that historians now call the Long Depression. It was 23 years long. At that time, they called it the Great Depression, because the 1930s hadn't come along yet. But it was a period of deflation. What was happening? Lord's return, restitution blessings, production, automation, all these wonderful things. The wealth or the goods and services are increasing dramatically, but the money supply is lagging. The money supply is not keeping up to buy the goods and services. So that means more goods and services are competing for a few dollars and prices have to fall. There is the problem. Now you might say, well, what was money in those days? Well, money was gold and silver. That's an 1873 silver dollar. You will never see one of these because most of them were melted down for the silver, turns out. Because it actually, at this time, it contained more than a dollar's worth of silver. This is an 1874 gold dollar. It had exactly $1 worth of gold. There's a 16-to-1 ratio, 16 ounces of gold equal 1 ounce of silver, and that's what a dollar was. Now, the thing that's interesting about that is that with the restitution, and really this is the period of the Second Industrial Revolution after the Civil War, as the quantity of goods and services increased at a breakneck pace, the amount of money to buy it with could not keep pace. Because in order for the money to exist, you've got to have gold and silver. Now, the expediency of Civil War, they realized, look, we're at war. We have to have things to spend. We have to stimulate the economy. We need to manufacture. We need to pay the troops. So they issued greenbacks, really, and these were in circulation from 1862 to 1879. And what had happened, this increased the money supply, stimulated the economy, but these notes were based on trust. Now, they were redeemable in gold and silver, but people didn't believe it. So what happened is the rich speculators bought them all up after the war, went to the treasury and said, okay, give us our gold and silver. And they had to do it, or else nobody would trust the government. So folks were selling it for 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar. The speculators took it, and they just made a killing by helping to deplete the treasury of the United States. But it was the deal that the government made, so there was really nothing wrong with that. But overall, people didn't like that. They wanted money you could bite. They wanted to take their this silver dollar. They want to take it and actually have something you could bite. So that means, you know, if you're going to have extra money in your money supply that is necessary for the health of the economy, where are you going to get it? Well, here's where you're going to get it. This guy's going to be out in the field. Here, there's your monetary advisor right there. How do you like that? That's your Alan Greenspan. He's the one who's determining if you're going to have money in your economy or you're not. It's whether this guy can pan enough gold. There is this little bag of gold dust. As a matter of fact, earlier, what was happening is these guys would come to town. They didn't have the mint to mint the gold. So they'd come in with a bag of dust, and they'd be buying things for dust. Guys would go into a saloon. And the saloon keepers, what they'd do is they'd hire the guys with the biggest hands they could find because a drink costs one pinch of gold. So they get these guys with these hands, you know, that are monsters, and come in like a steam shovel and take a pinch. You know, you might take $20 worth of gold for one drink that should cost, you know, 20 cents. But that's the way things was. Because when gold and silver, the literal metals, this is called specie, when that is backing up your money, nothing is really going to make sense in the long run. Not after the Lord returns. For centuries before, it may be okay, but not when the Lord returns. Everything's going to change. So there was pressure to build mints. There was a Carson City mint, which is now closed. There's also a San Francisco mint. Here's a picture of it. And here are the guys working, and they would actually take the gold, and they would mint it. And what you could do, and any citizen can do this. Now, think of this. Think of this think of somebody doing this today. You couldn't even comprehend it. They could take their gold nuggets, take it to the mint. The mint would assay it and say, yeah, it's got 90% gold in it. Fine, we'll go ahead and mint it. They would take it and mint it. So any individual who had a bag of gold, he could affect the money supply in the country independently because it was not based on the gross national product or the proportion of money in the money supply. It was dependent on, can you dig in the dirt and find some gold and silver? This really was. And really after, we'll talk about it. I don't want to give away the secret here. But there was a tremendous pressure because they realized they had to get more money into the money supply for the economy to be healthy. So when money is plentiful, you'll find that prices rise. Now, there was actually a lesson in history about that. In the 1500s, in the middle 1500s, the Spanish went and they stole gold from the Incas and from other places in South America. There's a little Incan man of gold, and there's a little Incan man of silver. And when these guys came over to Europe, they come over in by the ton. 181 tons of gold came to Europe, and 16,800 tons of silver came to Europe when they plundered the Incas. came to Europe, but they didn't bring over any more goods and services. They didn't put that into the economy. They just put in more spendable material, money. What happened? Inflation. Now, all the goods and services are competing for even more and more money, so prices rise. Well, if you're the guy with the gold and silver, it's great. If you're not, all the prices go up. You know, if you're on a fixed income, bad news. So, you know, people are talking about fixed incomes and the woes they're having. This is nothing new. They've already learned this lesson, you know, 500 years ago, 450 years ago. Well, what if money is scarce? And that was what was happening in our time period between 1873 and 1896. Money was scarce, so prices are dropping. They're dropping. Those goods and services, there's fewer dollars for the goods and services to compete for, and the merchants, they have to sell for less money. Prices drop. You have deflation, eventually depression. There's just not enough money. I remember my mom talking about the Great Depression. She said, oh yeah, bread was only a nickel, but nobody had a nickel. There just wasn't enough money in the money supply. So, what has to happen? Or who does this, what are the effects of this? Well, if you're a banker, you're lending money. And when you lend that money out and there's deflation, every year that those dollars get more and more valuable. And when they get paid back, the money you're getting back is more valuable than the money you lent out. Actually, in this time period, the deflation was about 3% per year. 3% per year. That's how much the money was growing in value. And that's how much harder it was to earn it. So if you're a farmer, you're borrowing money. You have to borrow money for your seed, borrow money for your equipment. You have to buy that. But what is happening is every year the prices of your crop is going down. Each dollar is getting more and more powerful. They're harder to come by. And it's just breaking you. You just can't repay. Well, the bankers are happy as long as they don't have to foreclose. But you can see this is really going to cause a devastation in the economy. So, what happens? Well, it turns out in 1897 something happened that Brother Russell doesn't talk about in the fourth volume because it happened after the fourth volume was completed. And that is, the Long Depression ends. It's over. Why? Because they found more gold. They found more money in the ground. Klondike Gold Strike in 1897. South African gold was now being produced tremendously. There's also a chemical process called sodium cyanidization of gold where you can extract 10 times more gold from the ore than they could before. It used to be you had to be able to see the little bits of gold, you know, the flecks, the nuggets. Well, this, you can just take these rocks. They look kind of brown. You can't see any gold. It's there, but it's so small you can't extract it mechanically, but you could chemically. So the money supply is up, prices rise, the economy is stimulated, everything's hunky-dory. Sounds great, doesn't it? The cries of the reaper is not going to stop simply because man found some gold lying in a hole in the ground. It's God's will the cries of the reaper is going to go on because Christendom's going down. So everybody was doing great, but not the farmers. They were the hardest hit. The prices are still down. Prices are still down. For both the United States and the nations of Christendom, divine right of kings over in Europe, it's still down. Well, this Long Depression's over. What's going on? There must be something else going on. Well, it turns out the United States and most of the countries of Europe were on a gold and silver standard. This was established in 1792 by Alexander Hamilton. And if we go back to 1873, we'll see when this standard was still in effect. There was a $1 gold coin that had a dollar's worth of gold in it. A silver dollar, similar to this one, has a dollar's worth of silver. 1 ounce of gold equals 16 ounces of silver. That was by law. By law. It was all by law. Now, if somebody happened to find a whole lot more gold, the price of gold would go down, and he'd use that gold to buy silver, because the silver is more expensive, or vice versa. So this was called Gresham's Law. And you find people taking the money, you know, buying the dollars made out of the more expensive metal, and they'd melt it down, sell it, and buy, you know, this endless cycle. There was no winning situation. It's an archaic, failed system from the beginning. And when the Lord returned, all it did was show that this system just doesn't work. Well, in 1873... The fact that this system doesn't work really came to a head. There was a coinage act in 1873, and what it says, we're not going to make silver dollars anymore. And effectively, it demonetized silver. In fact, it said it's not even legal tender. If you look at the act, no more than $5 worth of debts could be paid in silver dollars. Now, virtually nobody paid attention to that, but if you're a banker, you might get pretty picky about that. Silver is now a commodity. It's a commodity like, you know, strawberries. Pick another commodity. Wheat, corn, anything. So in other words, the price of silver, the value of silver is going to float with supply and demand. And when it's demonetized, people aren't interested in it as much. It's not money anymore. It's just a commodity. So what happens? Silver prices drop. In 1873, the price of an ounce of silver, now keep in mind, there's less than an ounce of silver in a silver dollar. Okay. But the price of an ounce of silver in 1873 is $1.30. By 1896, it's down to 68 cents. Here's where the years of the Long Depression from 73 to 97, but notice after this, wow, this price of silver is still way down. That's because it has become a commodity. It's been demonetized. That price drop is 48%. Well, if you're a farmer selling on the international market, there are still countries who will accept silver as money. Argentina, China. And this is the international market. You've got to accept the going rate in silver. So the farmers of Christendom, the farmers of the United States would have to accept this silver for their crops. But when they took it, they essentially got about 50 cents on the dollar for it. They would then have to convert that into gold because that was really the money. They'd have to take it, melt it down, you know, just sell it as a commodity. Take the gold, use the gold to buy the manufactured goods because that's what the standard was in this country, in England, and eventually all of Europe. This, right here, that continued long after this depression was over for everybody else, this continued to break the back of the farmers, to uproot the most stable part of society from the very foundation. And brethren, there's 1914. You'll see up to the 1914, it only, here we're at 68 cents, that was actually good in that period. This was devastating for the farmers. Well, why demonetize silver? Why does this make any sense at all? Well, if you're a manufacturer, you can buy raw materials and you're going to sell manufactured goods. Now, manufacturing, you got to buy expensive machines, engineer them, have labor, lots of capital. Not everybody can do this. So if you have a manufacturing monopoly, you can buy the raw materials virtually anywhere in the world. They're commodities. But once you manufacture them, that's something very special. You can sell high, name your own price. This is what England was doing. England, especially in the early 1800s, late 1700s, a good example is their monopoly of textiles. They would buy cotton, farm products from this country, from wherever they could, from India, etc., and they would bring it back to England where they would manufacture it into cloth and clothing, and they would sell that at a premium. They realized what was going on, and England demonetized silver in 1816. They knew this dynamic. Nobody was fooling them. England calls it, I think, the great game of politics and finance. England always makes sure that they're the ones who are on top. They could buy the cotton for cheap silver, but then sell the cloth for expensive gold because they had cornered the market on manufacturing. Now, when you take a look, here's the relative share of the world manufacturing output from 1750 to 1900. Here's England, this blue thing on top. Here are the other countries. Compared to England, especially in the middle 1800s, England really has the lion's share. As you can see, in 1874, there's England, but there's this little colony over across the pond that's starting to grow up, the United States. And what are they doing? They're starting to threaten that market. They're now producing manufactured goods, and they're going to threaten the market. England can't corner the market anymore. Well, the problem is, if you have competition, England has competition, well, what if their competitor will sell either for for silver or gold because they're on a silver and gold standard. Well, what that would do, that was undercut England's prices. So what could England do? Oh, my word. Would England lower its price? That's not the British way. They're going to get everybody else to raise their price without them even knowing it. And how they're going to do it? They're going to make the competitors demonetize silver too. So silver becomes cheap. This will keep the prices high for England and keep the prices high in the United States and all the rest of Europe. So in 1873, they demonetized silver, actually took a bribe. If you go to Wikipedia, you can see the information on the guy who came to this country and bribed the legislators who rewrote the law. In Europe, country by country, by the end of the 1870s, silver standard was gone. Well, how about for the farmers, for these reapers? What did this do? Well, it's deflation. Because initially back in 1873, when it's demonetized, that means lots of the money is now right. They're not making it anymore. It's not in circulation, so the money supply shrinks again. So we have deflation on one hand, but we also have the fact that the silver price is falling. The farmers have to take that international price. They're essentially getting half of what they used to in the value for their goods. They have to buy the manufacturing goods in gold because both the United States and Europe is on a gold standard. So they're getting this cheap silver. They got to turn around and buy expensive gold with it in order to get their manufacturing goods. So for the American farmers, this was very hard. For the Europeans, it was devastating. The Europeans had much smaller farms, and they were renting from folks who were ready to throw them out in the dirt, throw them out with the trash if they can't pay their rent. Europe is where Christendom was. This shook Christendom to the very foundation. Well, did these politicians, these wise men, did they understand what was going on? Well, Senator Thurman, the United States, he says, when the bill was pending in the Senate, we thought it was simply a bill to reform the mint, regulate coinage, and fix up one thing or another. And there's not a single man in the Senate, I think, unless a member of the committee from which the bill came, and he doesn't say, and received the bribe, who had the slightest idea that it was a squint toward demonetization. They didn't even know what they were signing. Here's another one. Senator Beck, the bill demonetizing silver was never understood by either House of Congress. I say that with full knowledge of the facts, not even newspaper reporters, and they're the peskiest folks of all, they didn't even know what was going on. Colonel Ingersoll, he says, I do ask for the remonetization of silver. Silver was demonetized by fraud. It was imposition on every solvent man, etc., etc. Senator Vance, the power of money and its allies throughout the world have entered into this conspiracy to perpetrate the greatest crime of this or any other age. In fact, this was referred to in history as the crime of 1873. It devastated the economies of continents, but the ones hardest hit were the farmers. The ones longest hit were the farmers. Everybody else eventually recovered, but the farmers never did. Prince Bismarck. Now, let's go talk about the divine right of kings, see what he has to say. I am too old to go to school over the currency issue, but I recognize that although I acted in 1873 on what I regarded as the best advice, my action was too precipitate. In other words, it's too fast, too hasty, in view of the results which have followed. The one class we cannot afford to estrange is the farming class. Well, guess what? It's going to happen no matter what you think or what you do, because it's the Lord's will. Because Christendom is going down. Well, was there help? Once they found out, oh, wow, look what has happened. We got to help these poor farmers. Well, it turns out in 1878, there's the Bland-Allison Act to so-called remonetize silver, but it didn't really remonetize anything. All it did was mint silver dollars. Here's an 1878 Morgan dollar. Here's one. The reason why this coin is in my hand is not because of the normal laws of the United States. This is an emergency measure to get some more money. And this is really very similar to this. This thing here. You recognize that he's got a little one on it, George Washington. This has about 50 cents worth of silver in it. Same amount of this as the silver dollars in 1873, but because silver is plummeting, they couldn't afford to put a dollar's worth in, would have made the coin twice as big. So people can spend these, but they're certainly not going to melt them down, because you get them for a buck, you get them for a dollar, and there's only 50 cents worth of silver in them. Now, the other thing about this is no longer could you take your silver to the mint and have your silver made, because that way you could take 50 cents worth of silver and make it into a dollar. So what the result is the farmers, when they're getting this foreign silver, they're stuck with it. It's still a commodity. All the Bland-Allison Act did was try to put some more money into the economy, not to help the farmers and their specific problem, but just to try to get some more lifeblood into the economy. That's all this did. One thing nice about silver, it has a nice ring to it. Okay. But if we look at the price of silver in 1873, the amount of silver that's actually in a silver dollar, in 1873 it was exactly $1. But the silver price starts going down eventually by 1896, essentially when the fourth volume was written. The amount of silver in a silver dollar is only 52 cents. This is what's called fiat money, where the money itself does not contain the value of it, does not contain its own face value. This dollar bill does not contain its own face value. It's a piece of paper. This only contains 50 cents of its $1 face value. So you can see the direction they were being forced to go. Having precious metals back up the money in an expanding economy does not make sense. But it would be a hard lesson. It would take years to learn. So the Bland-Allison Act, it increased the money supply. It helped inflation, but it was no help for the farmers. They still couldn't take their foreign silver and do anything with it. It was still a commodity in the United States and Europe. They were still getting 50 cents on the dollar. Well, there was also a Silver Purchase Act in 1890. This is interesting if you like scandals and et cetera. There are scandals all over the place. I mean, it was like the foxes guarding the chickens in the 1800s in our government. This was an act to buy even more silver. Well, we don't have enough money in this money supply. Oh, I know. We'll double the amount that we're buying. And the way we're going to buy it is we're going to issue notes. So people will buy these notes, and then they can redeem those for gold or silver. Well, what happens is the speculators are always smarter than the government is. And what they did is they bought the notes, and what did they redeem them for? Silver? No, silver prices are going down. They're going to redeem it for gold. So what happens? The gold supply and the treasury is threatened, and they're going to be depleted. So they have to repeal it, and they realize this was a scandal perpetrated by the officials in the treasury just to rob it of all the gold to make their friends rich. Kind of like the military-industrial complex that others have talked about later. Anyway, but here is what was happening. In other words, there was no way to fix this problem. There was no way. The toothpaste was out of the tube. You can't get it back in. Well, in 1896, William Jennings Bryan, this problem is just getting worse and worse. Why? Well, because the economy is just burgeoning. Goods and services being produced, not enough money. Even though they're buying more silver, you're still dependent upon there being silver to buy. It's got to be there to make it into money. So William Jennings Bryan, nice fella, 1896 Democratic presidential candidate, he gives this long speech, and a very famous part of it says, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Many, many biblical references in this. He was trying to get to the conservative farming element and others, labor, who still have perhaps had regard for the scriptures, and invigorate them and incite them with scriptures. But it was too late. There was no way to purchase the silver that would be necessary to put the money into the economy. He just couldn't do it. So what happens then? Well, if we ask, who did this? Well, it turns out it was the bankers of England who did this. What they wanted to do was, because they knew that United States manufacturing was starting to really take off and they were competing effectively with Great Britain, they said, okay, we're going to demonetize silver. That's going to raise all your prices because they're going to become gold prices. And that way, your prices are high, our prices are high, we can still compete. So that's what they did. They did this through bribery. Through Europe, they went around to all the crowned heads, very simple because they're all related. And they just convinced them to do it. And they said, oh, okay, yeah, you know, Uncle so-and-so or Cousin so-and-so down in England says I should do that. I said, okay, I guess. Well, the way of England's the way of the world. They seem to be pretty smart. Look at their big empire. Well, they had the big empire because they were robbing everybody else. Their own relatives in Europe didn't realize it. This really showed the ignorance of the kings and the politicians. They didn't understand their own economic systems. The kings were the pawns in the hands of the financiers. These financiers were much smarter than the rulers, those who were claiming to rule by divine right. What did this promote? Distrust of the kings, distrust of governments, distrust of folks who were supposed to be in power for the blessing of mankind. Now, they're in power because of divine right, or in this country, they're in power because they knew how to get elected. That's really how it worked. All this it added to the fuel of the growing flame of distrust of the powers of Christendom. By 1914, the damage was done. The farmers had good reason to lose confidence in their leaders. This demonetization of silver was just yet another big nail in the coffin of the old idea of the divine right of kings and the old order. It was going down. Jeremiah 22:13, woe unto him that buildeth this house by unrighteousness, and his chambers by wrong, that useth his neighbor's service without wages, and giveth him not for his work. This is exactly what happened. This is exactly what the billionaires, in fact, the folks who perpetrated this at that time, today, they would have been regarded as trillionaires. But they just wanted more money and more money. And they got it from the rest of the planet without them even knowing what was happening. Well, did any good come of this? Well, the wealth quite a bit of it went to the English bankers. Note that the Rothschilds were English bankers. What did the Rothschilds do? Well, Baron Rothschild holds in reprint 41, says he holds a mortgage on Palestine, on all of Palestine. In other words, what he did is he bailed out the entire country of Turkey with security for a loan of 40,000 gold dollars. Notice he lent them 40 million dollars in gold. He said, "Oh well, for security for that loan I'm lending you, I'll take the deed to Palestine." I'll hold that. Okay. That's how powerful this man was. Baron Rothschild and others planted colonies in Palestine, which have flourished exceedingly. You'll see in this Rothschilds. They're the ones who are funding Zionism. The Rothschilds, the Hirsches, and others, these Jewish financiers. The money was being taken from the rest of the world going to England. And then where was it going? It was going to regather God's people. Is there justice in this? Well, Russia and Europe, what did they do for centuries and centuries? They persecuted the Jews. They buffeted them. Whenever they get tired, there was a political scandal, in the government. They blame it on the Jews, go out and kill some or get rid of them from one town to another. But now Russia and Europe, they can be used to actually fund Zionism. How about that? The wealth that they had accumulated is now going to be used to fund the return of God's people to their homeland. Is there a precedent for this? Well, Egypt, when Israel left Egypt, what did they do? They spoiled Egypt. They took the gold with them. Well, where did Egypt get the gold to begin with? It was because of what Joseph did. He's the one who gave them the wise counsel to say, hey, you're going to have 7 years of famine. So, in 7 years of plenty, let's store it. And what Egypt did is that they took the wealth of the surrounding world, and in that famine, all that wealth funneled into Egypt. And then when Israel left, Israel took it with them, because God is the one who overruled that Egypt would have it, just so Israel could take it with them when they left. How about that? Let's take a look at the flow of gold. With the demonetization of silver, And this is a map, this is a 1914 map of the world. And where the shaded areas are, these are all countries that had at one time been colonies of the nations in Christendom. And you'll see what is happening is that wealth is all flowing into Europe, primarily into England. They had the greatest empire. So with the demonetization of silver, the bankers and financiers really gathering and funneling all this wealth, what do they use it to do? It's going to go right down there, right where God wants it to go, because he's regathering his people. How many, and the Jews, I mean, the Rothschilds aren't going to get their hands dirty doing this, but they're going to find many who hold on to the promises of God. And they're going to be saying every year, next year in Jerusalem, next year in Jerusalem. Well, now they're going to be able to own land, become farmers, scratch an existence out of the desert, out of the swamp. And it's all being funded, overruled by God. God owns all the gold and silver in the world, and he's going to make sure it's going to go where it's necessary to do his will. Well, after the Great War, a failed monetary policy continued. We had a Great Depression. In Germany, we had hyperinflation. Well, World War I ended with an armistice. This whole idea of lording it over your fellow man, you know, thousand-year Reich, this whole idea wasn't over. They wanted to reestablish a church state. This monetary system was still all messed up. Really results in World War II. How about after that? Also, before World War II, we had reparations, Germany having to pay millions and millions of dollars to other countries in reparations. How about after World War II? Did we do the same thing? No, after World War II, we have the Marshall Plan. Money actually flows back over to the countries that we were fighting. We're going to start blessing our enemies. And they won't be our enemies anymore. We have better monetary policy. In fact, in 1971, the gold standard was gone. In 1972, countries don't even use gold standard. Not a standard. They'll still use gold as a commodity, but it's no longer a standard. The gold standard is gone. This archaic system is gone. Well, what backs our money today? Here's a dollar. What backs this up? I can't redeem it for gold or silver at the Treasury, but a lot of things I can get for it. I can buy candy bars. In fact, when we were driving here, we stopped at a 7-Eleven or something, and it said three Hershey bars for a dollar. So this is a chocolate-based economy we have. Sister Karen was very happy to hear that. Also, it's backed up by what you can buy with it. Now you have to be smart of how you use to spend it. Then you can buy candy bars or cars or clothing or whatever. But this is why the GNP or the GDP, Gross National or Gross Domestic Product, is monitored so carefully in all the countries of the world, because they realize the proportion of money, the proportion of goods and services has to be maintained, or else you're going to have inflation or depression. And when you inflation or deflation, and when you have that, life is bad. People are upset. They want the economies to be healthy. So they finally started figuring that out. The euro, that's not based on gold and silver. What they're doing is they're monitoring the national products of all these countries, making sure the number of euros that are in circulation is going to be proportional. In fact, if you took all the gold that has ever been mined in the world, in the entire world, it's about $3.6 trillion worth. That's at $900 an ounce, and we used that number from just the other day. $3.6 trillion. There's twice that money in circulation in the United States right now to facilitate transactions. That's just in the United States. That tells you that having our money backed by gold and silver, it's a failed idea. It cannot work. A successful monetary system has to be based on responsible policymakers who have the good of the people in mind, who balance things properly. It turns out for a successful economy, what you want is you want a little bit of inflation, so that people will be stimulated to borrow money, spend it, stimulating the economy. So going back to what God was overruling in order to effect an upheaval, the most stable part of society, the foundation. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are enter into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton, but behold, now the judge standeth at the door. May the Lord have his blessing.